Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to great listeners who support this program voluntarily. Linda Gray, Bruce Enbody, Deborah Hoover, and Eileen Weber. If you'd like to help and you're able, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. Our voluntary subscriptions start at $5 a month. Late Marvin Gaye from 1970. He was singing about the Vietnam War. Some of it still applies today. Yeah, like that part right there. We don't need to escalate.
War is not the answer. For only love can conquer hate.
On the last day of August, President Barack Obama spoke from the Oval Office and declared that the combat phase of American operations in occupied Iraq are now over. In a moment, Dar Jamail, who has been a frequent, regular, and valued contributor to this program, who's visited Iraq countless times since we invaded in 2003, will join us to offer a reality check on what the president had to say. But first, let's give the president his moment. Here's an excerpt from his Oval Office address on August 31st.
Good evening. Tonight, I'd like to talk to you about the end of our combat mission in Iraq, the ongoing security challenges we face, and the need to rebuild our nation here at home. I know this historic moment comes at a time of great uncertainty for many Americans. We've now been through nearly a decade of war. We've endured a long and painful recession. And sometimes, in the midst of these storms, the future that we're trying to build for our nation, a future of lasting peace and long-term prosperity, may seem beyond our reach. But this milestone should serve as a reminder to all Americans that the future is ours to shape if we move forward with confidence and commitment. It should also serve as a message to the world that the United States of America intends to sustain and strengthen our leadership in this young century. From this desk, 7.5 years ago, President Bush announced the beginning of military operations in Iraq. Much has changed since that night. A war to disarm a state became a fight against an insurgency. Terrorism and sectarian warfare threatened to tear Iraq apart. Thousands of Americans gave their lives. Tens of thousands have been wounded. Our relations abroad were strained. Our unity at home was tested. These are the rough waters encountered during the course of one of America's longest wars. Yet there has been one constant amidst these shifting tides. At every turn, America's men and women in uniform have served with courage and resolve. As Commander-in-Chief, I am incredibly proud of their service. And like all Americans, I am awed by their sacrifice and by the sacrifices of their families. The Americans who have served in Iraq completed every mission they were given. They defeated a regime that had terrorized its people. Together with Iraqis and coalition partners who made huge sacrifices of their own, our troops fought block by block to help Iraq seize the chance for a better future. They shifted tactics to protect the Iraqi people, trained Iraqi security forces, and took out terrorist leaders. Because of our troops and civilians, and because of the resilience of the Iraqi people, Iraq has the opportunity to embrace a new destiny, even though many challenges remain. So tonight, I am announcing that the American combat mission in Iraq has ended. Operation Iraqi Freedom is over, and the Iraqi people now have lead responsibility for the security of their country.
Barack Obama speaking from the Oval Office on August 31st. Dar Jamail published Beyond the Green Zone a few years back, subtitled Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and more recently he published The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as I mentioned, he has been a very reliable source of real information about Iraq over the course of this conflict, and I appreciate his contributions not only to this program, but to the injured and failing journalism system in this country. Dar, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Peter. Always good to be with you.
And just first an open-ended question, then we'll go to the president's remarks. But what was your feeling on this occasion? Is it a momentous day in any way, shape, or form, or just another, you know, ugly day in the occupation?
Well, I think it's significant. Of course, I would disagree with Barack Obama on what's actually happening, but I think it's significant in that it's not necessarily a rebranding of the occupation, but it really is a kind of a signpost of a significant shift from a broad, overt U.S. military occupation into something where really it's kind of a signpost that marks the privatization of the occupation. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting thing because I don't think we've been here before in U.S. history where now there's actually more private contractors, and I'm not talking about only mercenaries, but all private contractors operating in Iraq. There's actually far significantly more private contractors in Iraq than there are U.S. military personnel, as the contractors' numbers have increased even more over recent months, as the military has seen a dramatic decrease down to about 50,000 troops. So it's really, I think the significance is that, you know, his speech is totally misleading and misrepresentational of what's actually happening, but it is a significant moment in the occupation of Iraq where it's really shape-shifting away from a giant 100,000-plus U.S. military strong occupation that's very, very overt for the world to see into a more shadowy, privatized, ongoing occupation.
And what is the headcount of contractors in Iraq roughly today? I know it was north of 100,000 when the so-called surge occurred, and we peaked out at roughly 150 in uniform troops.
Right. Well, like I said, you know, I want to be real clear that I'm not talking about only armed mercenaries.
Sure.
All private contractors, it's still well over 100,000. I mean, mm-hmm. when we talk about the people serving the food, doing the cleaning, doing work on bases, numerous other jobs, as well as the mercenaries, it still is up above, well above 100,000. So mm-hmm. we're still talking about a very, very large number of private contractors over there. And they've taken on a lot of these jobs. And I think that's what's really interesting now about Iraq, and I think why it's so gray and why it's really difficult for anyone to make really accurate predictions as to what is going to happen in the future, because we've never been here before where, you know, if it was a more clear-cut U.S. military-based occupation, then it'd be a lot easier to predict what's likely to happen. But I think while we don't know for sure how many troops in the future will be brought out or if more are going to be sent in, actually, because there have been fresh troops sent over to Iraq in just the last couple of weeks, while some of these others have been being brought out, one thing I think we need to look at as the baseline constants that I really don't see changing is the U.S. Embassy compound in Baghdad. This is a compound the size of 80 football fields. They just doubled the budget of the place. There's thousands of people that work there. It's extremely heavily armed and guarded, coupled with four what they call enduring bases, basically air giant air bases in Iraq, and that's of course where all the soldiers have pulled into and stationed themselves amongst the, with the contractors amongst these four main bases, and they're minimizing their time outside those bases. So again, they're trying. It looks like, at least from the base footprint pattern, that it is look like it's starting to kind of replicate what the U.S. has done as it's gone out and colonized other countries for its empire through history, where, you know, once the kind of general colonization is done, they'll pull back in within very, very heavily fortified and guarded bases. And when we look over history, the U.S. has these bases in over 100 countries around the globe now. And I think that's what they're trying to do in Iraq, except this time it's far more privatized.
Mm-hmm. And Dar, as we progress here, I want to talk a little bit about what was missing from the president's speech. There's a whole lot of stuff that he didn't talk about that I think is important to note. And I also want to talk about some of the things that he didn't say that the right-wingers from Wolfowitz to Rove to John McCain really wanted him to say. But first, I want to give the president to some extent his due, because he did honor a mealy-mouthed campaign promise. And I say mealy-mouthed because he was always very careful in saying that he would remove combat troops from Iraq, but never defining what the residual force level would be. And essentially, through the campaign, he maintained these kind of vague postures because the polling showed that he was viewed or perceived as the leading anti-war candidate. Even though he had this split position where it's get out of Iraq, that was a bad war, and double down in Afghanistan, that's somehow a good war. And so in a narrow sense, he did honor his campaign promise. And that's what the purpose of the Oval Office address was, in my view. And I think to the extent that he doesn't get some sort of a bounce out of this, part of it is the limits of the situation. I recall a few years ago, somebody put $25 billion in the defense budget or one of the supplementals for parades, for victory parades. And nobody's talking about victory parades except some nuts on the right like Paul Wolfowitz and John McCain. That said, I believe the president is, you know, he was navigating a very narrow passage last night, and it's largely one of his own creation. Because he did not take the opportunity to really put closure on the torture policies, on the excessive bombing, on the use of depleted uranium, on the wear and tear on our military, the way reserves were overworked and overdeployed, redeployed repeatedly, the materiel that were provided by state National Guard units were chewed up and not replaced. There are many negatives about the war that really belong at the, you know, the doorstep of George Bush and Dick Cheney, and the president has steadfastly refused to assign that responsibility. And so he ended up in a very difficult situation in the Oval Office speech, where he had to kind of walk through a minefield, as I say, that he helped create.
I think that's a really important point, Peter. Well, all that you just covered, but particularly your last point where, you know, Obama, through a series of ongoing huge compromises, has put himself in this position where he is walking this political tightrope where really he's kind of created a no-win situation for himself. And he did this as far back, or he started this as far back as 2006, way back when he was senator, before there was really even very much talk at all of him running for president. He gave a talk in Chicago, actually, and outlined a policy, a foreign policy in Iraq, of maintaining between a 50 and 70,000 strong U.S. presence in Iraq. He singled out, actually, northern Iraq at the time to keep troops over there as a strike force in the region. So, you know, he's been on this line for a long time, and he's been fairly consistent in keeping that. And right now, it's particularly illustrated in his talk last night, he appears to be moving forward with something that he was looking at 4 years ago. So that, and you know, the situation that he's created of trying to act as though he is continuing to fulfill this campaign promise of being adhering to this timeline, you know, I can respect that he's at least trying to do that. But at the end of the day, it's really clear in Iraq, I think, what we need to really look at as, you know, debate continues of what's going to happen and is the U.S. really going to pull out or not? Will they make the 2011 deadline and really get all the troops out? You know, I think the question is always going to come back to this, and it's a bit of a long question, but bear with me. Is
go ahead.
Do you think that the U.S. government and military has spent hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in Iraq, lost more than 4,300 soldiers, wounded more than 50,000 others, completely trashed its international reputation, and built an embassy the size of Vatican City and four enduring bases, and gone through all of this last 7.5 years of hell in Iraq, killed over 1 million Iraqis in the process, eviscerated the country, to at some point, whether it's in 6 months or a year or 2 years or 5 years, to just turn all those bases over and that embassy over to the Iraqi people and walk completely out of the country, all troops and contractors. Do you really think that's ever going to happen?
Well, and you put it very well, and you put it in a form I was just about to ask you. Do you believe that Obama will honor the Bush-negotiated Status of Forces Agreement that calls for all American troops to be out of Iraq at the end of next year? And I'm quite dubious about that, as you are. And we see the president softening the commitment he made last December 1st that American troops will start coming out of Afghanistan next summer. And, you know, I don't believe that. And we know Petraeus doesn't buy into it. The big talking points from the right wing on the event of August 31st and our nominal end of combat operations in Iraq was to repudiate the timeline for Afghanistan as wobbly as it already is framed. And so, you know, he has put himself in a very difficult position, particularly by openly escalating the war in Afghanistan and not so openly expanding our military activities into Pakistan, where we have no declaration of war, not even an authorization of to use military force. You can't say that Pakistan somehow is covered by the post-9/11 authorization. And likewise in Yemen, where we have been expanding the use of drones and other forces, very, very interesting strike forces. And we've also basically put out a death sentence on an American imam who has moved to Yemen, who has not been accused, tried, or convicted. So these are all very troubling parts of it. And to come back to the president's speech, Dar, if he had been speaking to the entire world last night, I think it would have been a very different speech, because he had the opportunity to pivot off of torture, to pivot away from this whole expansion of American presence on Islamic soil. He had an opportunity here to really turn the page, to use his phrase, in a much different way.
Well, he really did. And, you know, the bottom line, Peter, is I think if Obama was the real deal and was going to really repudiate Bush policy and make all the millions of changes that he had promised to make by coming in, you know, we would have been completely out of Iraq already. I mean, and I mean literally completely out of Iraq, no bases, no nothing. He would have closed Guantanamo within his first weeks of coming into power. He would have done away with the Patriot Act. I mean, we can go down the long laundry list of horrible policies set in motion by the Bush administration. But, you know, Obama is essentially powerless. And, you know, I'm up here in Seattle right now, and I have a close friend up here who recently met with one of the politicians up here, longtime Democrat Jim McDermott, mm-hmm. who basically made it very, very clear, speaking with them, said, look, President Obama has put himself in a completely compromised situation. Again, this comes back to what you already said, that he is basically laying in the bed that he has made for himself over a long series of compromises since he came into power. And he's basically tied his own hands and basically can't do anything. And so he's put himself in a position to be victimized by policy, by Bush administration policies, which the only way out of it would have been for him to come into office with guns blazing and just started getting rid of all these horrible, horrible policies. But instead, by making one compromise after another, here we are in Iraq. This is an occupation that I think is going to go on indefinitely, whether it becomes completely compromised, whether it gets down to 20,000 troops or remains at 50 or goes back up to 70 or 80,000. Only time will tell. But we have a situation now both in Iraq and Afghanistan where I think another factor we have to talk about is the peak oil factor, that again, with limited oil supplies on the planet, more and more powers like India and China and Russia needing more of that same oil, the U.S. in more of a compromised position, probably no longer the sole superpower when we look at now being in a multipolar world, and again, the U.S. sitting in Iraq and Afghanistan, Iraq extremely rich in oil, Afghanistan extremely important as far as transportation of natural resources like natural gas and oil, and as we move further past peak oil in the world, again, do you think the U.S. is going to release its control of these two very, very important countries when the entire world economy is essentially based on oil, and then particularly ours here in the U.S.? So, again, that's another thing I think we need to take into consideration when someone asks themselves, do you really think the U.S. is ever going to completely withdraw from Iraq?
And, Dar, in listening to the speech, watching the president on TV, I was struck by two critical factors. One was that he chose to sanitize the record of the Bush administration, praising Bush himself as somebody whom he disagreed with on policies, but never, questioned his patriotism or his commitment to the security of the United States. And that really irritates me because I think that Bush contributed to a less secure position for the United States in the world on many fronts. I believe that he's created a whole new generation of jihadists and what are called terrorists who will challenge the United States by putting their own bodies on the line in a variety of grisly ways. And secondly, I felt that he attempted to con us. Because in both Afghanistan and Iraq right now, we're trying to practice a kind of Vietnamization. And we know that didn't work in Vietnam. We left by helicopters from the roof of the embassy in a stark retreat. Now, we're not doing that in Iraq. We had an orderly departure of the last round of the so-called combat troops. But he barely alluded to the fact that, Iraq doesn't have a government right now. We're handing it off to nobody. There are security forces who I believe are largely influenced by loyalty to Shiites that are nominally in control of the streets right now. But because of the disarray at the top and what appears to be a U.S. plan to engineer some sort of power sharing between Maliki and Alawi, that we are still the occupying force there while we're pretending that we're no longer running that country.
Another really important point, because the situation is, if there was, well, who knows what would happen if the U.S. wasn't in there and they had this election. I think for starters, it'd be very clear Maliki would be out because he lost the election. And now the U.S. has, again, put itself in a position where it's a power broker. It's trying to still work behind the scenes and make horse trades and negotiations to avoid a continuing ramping up of chaos and bloodshed that's playing out on the streets of Iraq. in the midst of this power vacuum created by so much disunity within this Iraqi government. Meanwhile, we have the Kurds continuing to split off in the north, making their own oil deals with other companies from outside of Iraq. Meanwhile, we have slowly but surely, three steps forward, two steps back, but in the general direction we see it happening of Western oil companies slowly but surely working their fingers into Iraqi oil. So all of this is going on, and really we have a continuing situation in Baghdad where the Iraqi government is largely impotent, and the primary reason for that is ongoing U.S. meddling in the country that is long. And I saw this from the very beginning of the occupation, and it continues to this day, that as long as there is an Iraqi government that has ties to the occupiers, that government is always going to lack legitimacy among the Iraqi people. And that's historically redundant. We've seen that in occupations around the world. This is why the Palestinian Authority is completely distrusted in Palestine, and why Hamas won the last elections there. It's because any entity that ties itself to the occupier in any way whatsoever, it completely lacks legitimacy among the Iraqi people, and I think that's one of the biggest problems now in Iraq with this government, of why it's basically ineffective and can't provide security, among many other things that the Iraqi people are so desperate for. And I think that's another part of a glaring omission from Obama's speech, is the cost of this occupation on the Iraqi people. We're talking about more than 1 million dead Iraqis, untold numbers of wounded. We're still talking about, to this day, at least 1 in 3 Iraqis don't even have access to safe drinking water. I think that's an extremely conservative estimate. Staggering unemployment. There's basically still no normal life in Iraq. More than 90% of the people who fled the country, according to the UN's own studies, have no intention of ever returning. These are the more educated people, the people who were running the country in the first place, as far as from a technocratic perspective. So we have to remember the deep, deep cost of this occupation on the Iraqi people, and still from that perspective, there appears to be no end in sight. There's really no real reconstruction happening, nothing of value being done to bring the electricity and the water and other essential services back up to speed for the Iraqi people. And every day we still are looking at a pretty large amount, and sometimes extremely large amount, of violence playing out on the street.
And Dar, when we look at the political disarray in Iraq, and Vice President Biden has been there for a few days, trying to cajole them into some sort of resolution, and I think it's along the lines of the power-sharing agreement I alluded to a moment ago. But to what extent is this mess that we have today, politically, the direct legacy of the blunders of Paul Bremer? He's faded. I haven't seen any reference to him in the media at all in the last couple of years. But Bremer, if people don't remember him, was the leader of the occupation during the interim period before we installed the first puppet prime minister. And it really seems to me that it was Bremer's plan to break up the army and send all those people out into the streets with their guns and ammo to devise a government scheme that was based on religious and cultural identity, that made it very difficult during the first round of their parliament to really build any consensus. And then as the Sunnis decided to participate to some extent in the more recent election, it once again, at least in my view, reminded me of the huge catastrophic mistakes that Bremer made when he was running the country.
Exactly, and it's amazing how these people like he and Pearl and Wolfowitz have, you know, the real architects of this catastrophe, have basically walked away and been allowed to remain in the shadows to a largely complicit media, where these are the guys that, you know, these are the people that need to be being tried for war crimes if we really lived in a just world. And, Paul Bremer, head of the CPA the first year, he was the person who disbanded the Iraqi military overnight, essentially creating the core of the Iraqi resistance that then grew rapidly. He was the person responsible for the so-called de-bathification program, which basically expelled most of Iraq's technocratic class that were essentially running the country, where, but you know, completely overlooking the fact that under Saddam, if you wanted any kind of real government job, or you were a professional and you wanted the chance to use your skills, you had to declare yourself a Ba'athist. And of course, most of these people were really not Ba'athists, but you know, that's it. When you live under a brutal dictator that'll cut out your tongue for talking bad about him, and you're trying to survive and you're under the sanctions, you have to declare yourself a Ba'athist. So in a stroke of a pen, Bremer threw all those people out. So you had people coming into these positions to try to run the country that had no experience in how to do it. I mean, all these factors that Bremer set in motion, not even to speak of the basically total privatization of the country, of the 100 Bremer orders, of opening up the borders, of tax-free, regulation-free trade, letting foreign companies come in and essentially turn Iraq into an economic basket case, where literally creating a Great Depression in Iraq overnight, where unemployment escalated, independent business had no way to operate and compete in that type of environment. I mean, it was basically a corporation's dream that Bremer did by coming in and doing what Naomi Klein refers to as the shock doctrine of basically shock economics. And it basically, you know, it killed what was left of Iraq. And Iraq has never recovered, and this is all thanks to all the actions that Paul Bremer himself conducted during that first year of the occupation when he was the U.S. Viceroy. He was head of the Coalition Provisional Authority.
Mm-hmm. Also, and you know, we can no longer expect Obama to reflect the kind of notions that I think are important, because he has set up this unconstitutional policy of official obstruction of justice by essentially declaring that nobody from the Bush administration will be investigated or ultimately held accountable for lawbreaking that occurred. But literally billions of dollars, some of it shrink-wrapped and on pallets, just disappeared in Iraq. We have bungled reconstruction projects where the cost overruns were greater than any nuclear power plant that, you know, ever had a cost overrun in the United States. And we have projects that were just stalled midway through. The contractors got paid, but, we didn't get any money back or any settlements from that. And so the amount of profiteering and corruption that has occurred and that continues in Iraq today and continues unabated in Afghanistan today, didn't even get a passing comment from the president.
Well, exactly. You know, and that's just another example of how he is essentially given a pass of all the egregious mistakes committed, not mistakes, but policies committed by the Bush administration, and has really played party to it. And this is a perfect example of how Obama has compromised himself so much from the very beginning, to where he's put himself in a position now where he really is, you know, kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, regarding just about anything at this point. That the only way he has out at this point, in my opinion, that would really earn the respect of the majority of the people of this country who voted him into power, would be to basically stand up and really be progressive and overturn these policies, and get rid of some of these, so many of these people in his cabinet that are so corrupt. But again, you know, we live in a country where the government is basically controlled by corporate power, and you know, who's going to stand up and do that when they feel that their whole political career would be over, and they understand that by taking these actions, it would basically have them removed from power, from having their campaign funding pulled, or even worse. And so that's the situation that we live in. Obama has made one compromise after another, especially with Iraq. And, you know, the fact that he won't talk about real compensation for Iraqis, the fact that he won't talk about the fact that this whole war was fought on the lies and the bogus pretenses of the Bush administration, the fact that he won't talk about the true cost of this occupation to the Iraqi people, and they won't talk about going after Bush, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Bremer, etc., and bring them to justice for this horrible crime that the invasion and occupation are. I think that, you know, that just underscores his illegitimacy as president and as someone who ever really had, you know, really true intentions in Iraq. And maybe earlier on, before he became president, he really did have legitimate intentions. But, you know, you don't get to be president of the most one of the most corrupt, probably the most corrupt government in the Western world and be able to maintain those pure intentions.
Mm-hmm. And, Dar, before we move on to some of the right-wing critics, any other thoughts that we haven't covered that you'd like to mention about this transition or about the Obama administration's posture?
I think I would just simply reiterate, really, I think for people to keep their eye on the ball of what's going to happen in Iraq in the future is, you know, this underneath all the rhetoric and all the talk of the status of forces agreement, et cetera, is remember that the SOFA is riddled with loopholes and gray areas, and that's why just a couple of weeks ago we had the head Iraqi general come out publicly and say that Iraqi security forces won't be able to stand on their own until at least 2020. And part of one of these loopholes in the status of forces agreement is, okay, the U.S. will leave at the end of 2011 unless invited or asked assistance by the Iraqi government. Mm-hmm. So we're already seeing these balloons being floated out in the media by Iraqi generals or Iraqi politicians of asking the U.S. to stay. So we need to keep that in mind, and we also, just to reiterate, keep in mind the U.S., what the U.S. has paid to be there, what they have suffered to be there, and what they've caused in Iraq in order to have this permanent military footprint there. And whether it's a privatized footprint or a military footprint or a bit of a mix of both, which I think it will end up being, as we move forward, just keep your eye on the bases, keep your eye on the embassy, and keep your eye on how the Iraqi puppet government reacts as far as whether they continue to invite the U.S. to stay or whether they would actually stand up and say, okay, you can leave completely now. And those are the key factors to watch as we go forward in the future. And I think it's pretty clear my position is I think that, you know, we will see a continuation of bases there. We will continue to see a military presence there and an ever-growing private contractor presence well beyond the end of 2011.
Dar, where is Muqtada al-Sadr? And where are the butter brigades?
Muqtada al-Sadr is once again has positioned himself in to be a kingmaker in Iraq because of all, you know, anytime there's extreme chaos and disunity and the government starts to fragment politically and everyone, we really get into the sectarianism and people kind of pull back within their own factions. He has the ability, because of the number of people in his who back him, to show up and basically throw his weight behind who he decides to throw his weight around in a very politically advantageous way for himself, and that's where he is now. So he is in a situation where he can make or break whatever plans are being made between Maliki or Alawi to basically do that. His Mahdi army was basically taken offline. I'll get to the Badr Brigade in a minute.
His Mahdi army
was taken offline because of a lot of corruption, and he had lost control over parts of it, and there was retraining. But certainly we have to understand that that is still there. He's, of course, laying low with that. He's not going to use his militia unless push comes to shove, and I think right now he's playing it very smart politically by only using diplomacy and not using the arms of his very massive Mahdi army militia. The Badr Brigade is actually the armed wing of what was formerly known as the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. They're a largely Iranian-trained, well, they're basically, they started in Iran and then came over into Iraq with the U.S. occupation, and they've been also a very effective militia throughout southern Iraq and have actually come to blows, so to speak, with the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr. And the Badr army, for the most part, has been folded over into the Iraqi government security apparatus, as has part of the Mahdi army. And this just shows us when we had massive political disunity at top, as we do right now in the government in Baghdad, what happens with these security forces that are primarily composed of either former resistance fighters or members of various militia. It's basically a recipe for chaos and bloodshed that's going to start playing itself out on the street.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for that update. And I had kind of mixed up the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army. So thanks for clarifying that. Now, to some of the talking points, the coordinated talking points of the Republicans on the day that Obama gave the Oval Office address were really twofold. One was that the surge worked and that we are victorious in Iraq. And secondly, that this is the reason why we should abandon the president's squishy timeline for starting to pull American forces out of Afghanistan. First, to the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, Stephen Hadley, who was Bush's national security head during the second term when Condoleezza Rice was promoted for her failures to Secretary of State, Stephen Hadley wrote a piece of revisionist history about, A, why we went into Iraq was because Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, kind of as simple as that. And then the surprise of the resistance and the civil war that developed, they call it sectarian violence. And then, of course, to toot the horn of Bush to add 20,000 American troops in January of 2007, the much vaunted surge. And he concludes his article with this. He says, although a majority of Americans had long since turned against the war by 2007, they understood that how we left Iraq and the Iraq we left behind mattered greatly. Those of us who had lived through Vietnam, a withdrawal under fire, a broken military, a national crisis of confidence, did not want to go there again. Albeit reluctantly, the American people gave the new strategy and our men and women in uniform the time they needed to succeed. To his credit, President Obama has built on this success. As promised, he is continuing to bring our troops home, but without jeopardizing what's been achieved. His next task is to recognize a long-term diplomatic, economic, and security partnership between Iraq and the United States. As he does so, it will help Iraqis achieve a brighter future and make the U.S. effort in Iraq a hard-won success for all Americans. So Hadley positions that we will be successful and that the surge itself was successful. He doesn't quite get to the victory word. We've got a subject in a moment who I'll raise who does. But what is your reaction to Hadley's revisionism, Dar Jamil?
Well, gosh, I mean, it's amazing the gall and how much these people rely on inattentiveness of the American people and a complicit media that allows people to forget who caused the situation, who set the stage for this entire disaster to occur and to continue to occur, and the architects of it, which is exactly what you and I started this whole discussion with, talking about the Wolfowitzes, the Pearls, the Rumsfelds, the Bremers, go on down the list, and this revisionist history of you know, and gosh, I mean, pick one sentence of that thing, and we could spend a lot of time on it. I mean, the whole thing of the surge working. I mean, and you and I have talked about that over the last couple of years. That the reason violence dropped in Iraq had nothing to do with the surge. It had everything to do with buying off the resistance and reinstituting a plan to control the Iraqi population by buying off key tribal sheikhs and to control the people underneath them, which is the same strategy that Saddam Hussein used, and that was implemented in the middle of 2006, long before the first troop associated with the surge stepped foot in Iraq.
Don't forget the statement
that you just read. I mean, it's so full of inaccuracies. It's literally just propaganda, and we need to, and that puts us in a position where we have to step back and basically dissect it line by line and point to how the entire thing is flawed, ergo the entire assumption or argument that, well, this is all thanks to Bush policy and the surge, and, you know, we've created victory in Iraq, and, you know, Obama's basically just benefiting from conservative policy, this kind of thing. I mean, it literally is that revisionist history, and it has no factual basis to it whatsoever.
But it has a rather sinister impact in that they have pushed Obama beyond his former intellectual honesty about the surge, because as a candidate, he was dinged by McCain in one of the debates for not embracing the surge as a success. But he pivoted on December 1st in the West Point speech about the escalation in Afghanistan, making totally false comparisons between the two conflicts and the ability to localize control with a stable future. That's questionable in Iraq. It's out of the question in Afghanistan, in my view. But we really have seen the president pushed by the right and by his choice of keeping Gates and surrounding himself with hardliners at the NSC and in the whole national security system, the intelligence community. So he has really, again, put this straitjacket on himself, where he now is forced to pretend that the surge in Iraq was a success and not to parse it the way you and I have just here in the last couple of minutes.
You're exactly right. And he has put himself in a position through his numerous compromises and making these concessions and saying, well, okay, yes, we do have to attribute some sort of... I mean, it's a slippery slope, Peter. Let me just back up. It's such a slippery slope. It's like lying. And it is lying, because once he concedes anything that the Bush administration did as being positive in Iraq at all, which you cannot. The whole thing was based on lies, and it's been a murderous, deadly disaster from the very start and continues to be to this day. And once you make any concession to that whatsoever for political gain, as Barack Obama has, then you've completely compromised yourself, you've lost all legitimacy, you've completely usurped all the promises that you made, you've betrayed all the people that you led to believe that you were going to end the war and do the right thing and correct the problems in the United States and do away with all of these horrible Bush policies. And Obama has put himself in that position to where he's basically given power over to these people, that once he basically conceded anything to them whatsoever, conceded anything to these lying war criminals that have been the right wing and associated themselves with the Bush administration all through that horrible 8 years, then he's compromised himself. And so he really has been his own worst enemy insofar as tying his own hands behind his back to where, you know, it's like he should, if he was really sticking by his guns from the beginning, then he would be able to just laugh at these people and just point out their inaccuracies, their lies, their misrepresentations for exactly what they are. But since he's gone along with most of them now because of serving his own political expediency and his own political plans, he's put himself in a position where he can't do that because he granted them the legitimacy that now they have in the political sphere, that is.
And, Dar, before we went on the air here, you and I were talking about how bizarre it is to feel somewhat relieved that John McCain didn't lose his primary to John McCain, the loudmouth, J.J. I'm blocking because I can't stand the guy. Hayworth, J.D. Hayworth. And how bizarre these times are, because John McCain chose to compromise himself on every aspect that gave him a shred of credibility or respect in the past. And he has completely traded his soul and any independence that he used to have from his party's far right wing just for political survival. And we're talking on the day when Senator Murkowski from Alaska has conceded to the Tea Party challenger. The Murkowski family, her dad and her, are really part of the worst legacy of the Republican Party. But to see that displaced by something even worse just puts us into a spin. So hold on to your hat, because here are a couple of quotes from John McCain's op-ed in the August 31st Wall Street Journal. He said, President Obama will likely point out in his address that Iraq still faces major challenges, foremost its inability to form a government, and that neither American sacrifice nor our commitment to Iraq's success is ending today. Yet our troops are returning with honor, which makes this a fitting time to reflect on the causes of their victory and on what lessons from Iraq can help us win the war in Afghanistan. I mean, wow. Is he on ecstasy? is it some sort of special meth that's only available in Arizona? If you can bear it, one more paragraph. Though most Democrats still cannot bear to admit it, the war in Iraq is ending successfully because the surge worked. In 2007, President Bush finally adopted a strategy and a team in Iraq that could win. He worked constantly to build public support for the policy. Just as important, the surge worked because it was clear that success was the only exit strategy. U.S. troops would meet their objectives, and then they would withdraw. I mean, this is bizarre, and it's a fantasy world. To try to, this goes beyond spin, this is pure fabrication.
It is. It's delusional, and I guess we should expect nothing else from a guy like John McCain. It really is amazing. I mean, Jeff Millard with Iraq Veterans Against the War was in D.C., I think it was roughly a month ago, and met John McCain and came up to him and introduced himself. Hello, I'm Jeff Millard with Iraq Veterans Against the War. And John McCain laughed in his face and said, oh, we already won that one. I mean, this is the world that these people live in. It's like their own little mental green zone where they're so out of touch with what's actually happening in reality. But such is Washington, D.C. Such are things on the Hill right now, I suppose, you know, in such a widespread way. And this is a huge problem. And these are, you know, what you were talking about before the McCain quotes is such, you know, we're in such dangerous times. I mean, I can remember when as bad as George Bush was, you know, comparing him, making the same comparisons. Well, we thought his dad was bad. We thought George Bush Sr. was horrible, and he was mild and much easier to deal with and at least quasi-rational by comparison. And now we're just continuing forward in this kind of another dangerous slippery slope of talking about, you know, gosh, you know, Lisa Murkowski, and I lived in Alaska for 9 years before I went over to Iraq, and he, you know, the Murkowski family, they're horrible. I mean, they're as pro-corporate as you can possibly get, and now they're being upended by people who are even worse, and we're seeing this trend all across the country, and I think it's such dangerous times because historically, when a country's in big economic trouble, it really opens up the door when people are afraid, they're struggling, people aren't making it economically, for a demagogue to step in, someone who's going to be the savior and step in and make everything okay. And now we have a group, the Tea Party, pretty well positioned. I hate to say it, but I think it's an honest assessment where, you know, the idea of a Sarah Palin being in a position with a couple of big unforeseen things that could happen to kind of further her position, where I don't think it's out of the realm for somebody like that to be really well positioned to run for president, and because of how politically unstable and dangerous and basically insane things have become in this country, thanks largely to the ongoing compromises of those in power. And I would say not just Obama, but we can look at most Democrats, with few exceptions aside, across the board. You know, when you start compromising and treating these people as though they're sane and there's any legitimacy to their argument whatsoever, mm-hmm. then you've compromised yourself out of a real position of power.
Yeah, and there is no real Democratic voice speaking up and saying, excuse me, the surge didn't work. That is a fabrication. That's a fantasy. I give Rachel Maddow credit for being the strongest voice in the corporate media, but she has a limited focus and doesn't touch on a lot of these things that we've talked about that were missing from the president's speech and that are used to con people or to sanitize the recent history. And so we don't have any strong voices to counter these false narratives that are being pushed forward. And Dar, as I alluded to earlier, the linkage of the so-called success of the surge and our so-called victory in Iraq is linked to talking points that surfaced both in the McCain op-ed in the Journal and in a separate article two pages away where a columnist named William McGurn talks to David Petraeus and other administration officials And the pull quote reads, "The president's advisors agree we're not leaving," this is Afghanistan, "next July." So that is the whole pivot point where they're trying to use the liability, the exposure, the compromise that we've described of the Democrats, including those in the White House, right up to the so-called commander-in-chief, to push forward an open-ended occupation of Afghanistan, regardless of the consequences and the very real costs and failures that are evident to more than 60% of the American people.
Well, very good points, Peter. And, you know, again, it's where we have our work cut out for us, that I think we have to simply, all of us have to remember that, you know, the real, what we can't allow ourselves to be deluded from history and forget what happened and the events that transpired to bring us to this point. And it's our job to keep those politicians, the Democrats particularly, that look, if they're not going to remember that and be responsible and basically behave like adults and stand up and represent the people that voted for them in the way that they promised, then they need to be they need to go, and we need someone who will. And you know, it's our responsibility not to compromise on any of this, even though our politicians are corrupted and allowing themselves to be all over the map with this stuff. It's our responsibility as journalists and citizens to you know, not forget history, not forget what brought us here, and certainly not forget who was responsible.
Dar, I want to thank you for your clear thinking, your strong points of view, and your commitment to reality. You've been a great partner in covering at least this phase of our invasion and occupation of Iraq. Like you, I suspect that it will go on much longer, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. You've been doing great coverage of the recent debacle and calamities in the Gulf of Mexico, and I appreciate that. But I do want to commend to people your more recent book, The Will to Resist, because there are still soldiers refusing to fight, particularly in Afghanistan, and that's a story that needs to be told, needs to be known. And once again, Dar Jamail, I thank you.
Thanks again, Peter, very much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Were we victorious in Iraq?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.